listeners, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. If you've been to a bookstore lately, I bet you've noticed the bountiful new crop of celebrity memoirs. So many out there, which to choose? As your literary guide, I've done the research and picked what I hope you'll agree is the cream of the crop. And here's a bonus. The ones we'll preview today are read by the author. You just can't get any closer to the story than that. So let's start getting the inside story on some of your favorite celebrities as we turn to page one of the book report.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains. But it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain. And when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
Most people know Penny Marshall as the director of Big and A League of Their Own. What they don't know is her trailblazing career was a happy accident. In My Mother Was Nuts, readers get a backstage pass to Penny's personal life, her breakout role in The Odd Couple, her exploits with Cindy Williams and John Belushi, and her travels across Europe with Art Garfunkel on the back of a motorcycle. We see Penny get married and divorced. And married again, this time to Rob Reiner. And we see Penny at work with Tom Hanks, Mark Wahlberg, Whoopi Goldberg, Robert De Niro, and Whitney Houston. Throughout it all, from her childhood spent tap dancing in the Bronx to her rise as a star of Laverne and Shirley, Penny lived by simple rules. Try hard, help your friends, don't get too crazy, and have fun.
I can't, I said. I'm doing a movie. I wore them on camera. I have to match in the shots. They exchanged looks, and I suppose, this being Hollywood, they understood. They grabbed some cameras on a shelf instead. By now, my facial mask had hardened, making it difficult to talk. As the bad robber went to look around the house again, he instructed his ninja partner, a.k.a. the good robber, to watch me. He said something along the lines, if she moves, kill her. He had watched too many movies. Still, I wondered how that would work. Would he impale me with his ninja sword, cut off my head? Would his blade go through my face mask? When the bad robber was gone, I turned to his partner and said, I'm going to wash this mask off my face. I didn't ask. I told him. Then, without waiting for an answer, I went into the bathroom, scrubbed my face, and returned. My robber was surprised when he saw my face. Oh, my God, he said. If we had known it was you, we never would have come up. Well, you could leave any time, I said. He didn't move. Neither did I. We stared at each other, unsure what to say next. It was like being in a bad improv class. Is this going to be your career, I asked. No, I'm going to college, he said. All right, I said. So this is just a part-time job. Then the bad robber returned. He was frustrated by how little I had in the way of loot. He looked at me as if it was my fault. I started to explain that had I had known I was going to be robbed, but I did have traveler's checks, which I got out. In the meantime, the phone had continued to ring, and this time I picked it up. It was my friend Susan Forrestal from New York checking in. I told her that I couldn't talk. Later, she told me that because I had hung up so quickly, she thought I was with someone having sex. Not quite. And when the phone rang again, the bad robber, now annoyed, took the ninja sword and destroyed it, reminding me of my old friend John Belushi's Samurai Warrior character. Of course, this being my life, as soon as the phone was in pieces, another extension began to ring. What can I do? I said, shrugging. Just sign the traveler's checks, he said. You know, I think I have to be there in person when you cash these, I said. Just sign, he said. I'm sorry I don't have more for you, I said. I have a Roy Rogers plate in the kitchen I think might be a collector's item. The phone rang again, and I answered it. This time it was the police, a Lieutenant so-and-so. Are you okay, he said. So far, I said. Do you know these people? No. He asked a number of additional questions. Since we had already established the basics, they struck me as superfluous. Actually, they struck me as stupid and pointless. I was being robbed. The robbery was in progress. The robbers were in my home. I did not know them. They were robbers. What more mattered? Annoyed and frustrated, I turned to the bad robber and held out the receiver. It's for you, I said. I just couldn't deal with the cop anymore. It's okay, we know why, I heard the robber say. She owes us money. Then he handed the phone back to me. He looked just as irritated with the cop as I was. Neither of us wanted to talk to him. Hello, I said. Do you know him, the cop asked. No. Do you owe him money? No. Are there weapons? Yes. All of a sudden, we heard a helicopter hovering overhead and the house filled with a bright light from its spotlight. I have a lot of glass doors and windows, and all I could think was that the police were going to shoot through the glass and I was going to have to pay for it, in more ways than one. I told the cop on the phone that I had to go. Then I turned to the robbers. It was time to talk common sense, not dollars and cents. Listen, you see that helicopter up there, I said? Now, the three of us are in the same situation. They're going to come through here and probably shoot you, and maybe me too. I don't know. But there is a way out of here, out the back and down the hill. So they took off one way, and I went upstairs. There were cops everywhere. I told them the robbers had scrambled down the hill, adding that they didn't have guns. I didn't want them shooting anyone, especially the ninja going to college. He seemed like a nice kid. I didn't have to wait long for a resolution. Within a few minutes, cops down the hill radioed that they had caught the bad robber. He was hiding in the neighbor's bushes down the street. They wanted me to identify him, but they wouldn't bring him back to my place because he wasn't on my property. Instead, I had to go outside in my pajamas in front of all the press that had gathered, get in a cop car, and let them drive me down to the bottom of the street where they were holding him. His mask was off, but I nodded in acknowledgement. That was the same guy. Like a bad ninja, he scowled at me. I should have killed you when I had a chance, he said. That's pleasant, I said.
We've just heard My Mother Was Nuts by Penny Marshall. Readers, here's a book report first. We've just listened to Penny Marshall. Now here's a bestseller from her brother, Gary Marshall, and My Happy Days in Hollywood. Called a legend in his own time slot, Gary Marshall has been among the most successful writers, directors, and producers in the U.S. for more than five decades. As a comedy writer who began writing for Dick Van Dyke, Marshall went on to produce some of the most beloved sitcoms in TV history, including The Odd Couple, Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and Mork and Mindy. And his enormous influence as a director has been felt in film as well, in such classics as The Flamingo Kid, Beaches, Pretty Woman, and The Princess Diaries. Marshall takes us on a journey from his stickball-playing days in the Bronx to Hollywood, sharing the joys and challenges of working with the Fonz, a young Julia Roberts, and the street performer Robin Williams, among many others. This honest, often hilarious memoir reveals a man whose career has been defined by his drive to make people laugh. And his personal philosophy, despite tremendous achievements, has always been that life is more important than show business. To quote his sister Penny, "Thanks to my brother, I have a life. I'm sorry I almost ruined his during Laverne and Shirley."
On a movie shoot, days are long and nights can feel even longer. Emotions run high all the time, and people occasionally get sick and even faint. While the on-set nurse was tending to Julia, I went over to try to figure out what was wrong. "What did you eat today?" I said. "Half an avocado," she said. "Maybe you should have gone for the whole avocado, and then you wouldn't have fainted." She said she would try to remember that. Then I shared my can of tuna fish with her. I always carry tuna fish with me on the sets of my movies, in case I need a shot of protein. So Julia and I shared a little protein and conversation and then got back to work. Working with an actress trying to stay thin is nothing new to me, but it's still worrisome. I made a point of seeing that Julia ate healthy food every day. Eating for me is one of the joys of filming a movie. At what other time in your life do you have complete access to a private chef and whatever food you want, 24 hours a day? But for young actresses trying to stay thin, a movie set can present too much temptation and trouble. While Julia was new to life on a movie set, Richard was a veteran by the time we shot Pretty Woman. I spent a lot of time with him talking about life and his career. He is a complicated person. He enjoys getting to know people, but at the same time he works hard to preserve his time alone. Comedy for him, as for Matt Dillon, does not come naturally. Matt and Richard love to play brooding, sexy characters, but sometimes they lack the confidence to reach out for the big joke. So as with Matt on Flamingo Kid, I gave Richard comedy roads to venture down. He bravely took them and did a wonderful job. One of my favorite scenes in the movie takes place in an opera house. We were originally supposed to film inside the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco, but the Loma Prieta earthquake hit in October and the location was damaged. Instead, our brilliant production designer, Albert Brenner, built an opera set for us in Los Angeles. In this particular scene, Richard delivers a beautiful speech about his love of opera. As a counterweight to his passionate words, I gave Julia some opera glasses to play around with. Richard knew that Julia was going to get the big laughs from flipping and flopping about with the opera glasses, and he wanted to exit the scene early. It was not always easy for him to be her straight man. To put a twist on the scene and make him happy, I gave him a new ending to the scene. When Julia turned to another patron and said she liked the evening so much she almost peed in her pants, I had Richard jump in to cover for her and say, "She said she liked it more than the Pirates of Penzance." When Richard saw the final cut of the movie, he beamed with pleasure at his delivery of the joke because he got such a big laugh. Some stars introduce you to their agents, but Richard introduced me to the Dalai Lama. I went to an event where His Holiness was speaking, and Richard and I stood in a receiving line to meet him. When we finally got to where the Dalai Lama was standing, Richard introduced me by saying, "Your Holiness, this is one of the funniest men you'll ever meet." I was embarrassed because that is an uncomfortable way to be introduced to the most famous living Buddhist. However, I quickly covered and said, "Your Holiness, I read that we are the same age." Showing his sense of humor, the Dalai Lama said, "And we both have done well." It was not like the Dalai Lama had met so many funny people in his life either. I couldn't imagine he had spent much time at the Improv in Mumbai or the Comedy Club in Delhi. My love of playing pranks continued on Pretty Woman, and most of them involved trying to get Julia to laugh, because nobody laughs better than Julia. There is a scene where she takes a bubble bath in Richard's hotel room. She is listening to music on headphones, but at one point she takes off the headphones and goes under the water. During one take, the minute she went under the bubbles, I had the whole cast and crew run off the set. When she came out of the bubbles, she was surprised to see that she was sitting on an empty set and broke into a full round of giggles and a couple of choice swear words, too.
We've just heard My Happy Days in Hollywood by Gary Marshall.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains. But it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain. And when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
Selbo writes for film, TV, and theater. Her film credits include Melrose Place, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Part 2, Little Mermaid, Ariel's Beginning, Cinderella 2, and the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. She heads the MFA in screenwriting at Cal State Fullerton and is co-author of the Journal of Screenwriting. Welcome, Jewel. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, you're originally from North Dakota. Can you share a bit about your journey to Hollywood?
Well, I went to high school in Fargo, North Dakota at North High, and I went to SMU in Texas for undergraduate, where I was in the theater program. I wanted to go to the East Coast when I was a kid, but my father thought I would get corrupted. And so it took until I got out of graduate school for me. I went to graduate school at UNC Chapel Hill to move to New York. And there I had a play done off Broadway, and an agent saw it, took me under his wing, and I was writing for film and television pretty quickly when I was still living in New York. I did a movie Paul Morrissey, who was one of Andy Warhol's filmmakers, while I was still in New York, and I did the George Romero series Tales from the Dark Side and Monsters, and I did a daytime soap. And all my friends who were writers said, why are you putting yourself in that 5% of people who work in television and film in New York when you can be in Los Angeles? I don't think it's the same anymore, but it was kind of back then, 20-some years ago. And then also our best friends were having twins out in Los Angeles, and they were premature, and we went out to help, and we never came back.
Oh. Well, considering you've written for theater, TV, and the big screen, for someone wishing to break into the field, is one of these mediums easier than the other?
No. they all have their own challenges, which I totally enjoy. But it all comes down to story and character. And if you can create great characters and put them in a wonderful story where they're challenged and there's lots of conflict, the time frame doesn't matter, whether it's an hour and a half, 2 hours for a feature, an hour for a television show, 10 minutes for a little animated segment on an animated show. You still have to have a beginning, middle, and an end, and the character still has to go through some kind of journey. So obviously, you spend more time on features because they're longer, but I would say a 10-minute little animated thing has got its own challenges because you have to compress everything, but the characters still have to be emotionally involved and go through something.
Your credits include a number of films for kids and animated features. How did you come to specialize in that?
Well, it was kind of weird. And that wasn't weird, but I'd done a movie for Paramount Pictures, and it was an adaptation of a novel by Rachel Ingalls called Mrs. Caliban. And the movie never got made. I got paid for writing it, which was great, but I loved writing it. It was a great story about a woman whose child had died, her marriage fell apart. One day she walks into the kitchen, and there's a 6-foot monster in her kitchen, and I'm kind of remembering what I put into it, but because her book is kind of a one-person monologue thing, but he helps her through her grief process. And the script, I still think, is one of the most wonderful stories and wonderful scripts, but it never got made. But someone at Disney had read it, and so he decided that since I could write a monster, that I could write for the Hunchback of Notre Dame sequel. So they offered me that job, and I had a young daughter at the time who I thought it would be great she'll see, you know, one of these movies and I'll have written it. And so then I started working for Disney, and I loved them over there. They are great with story and working with them. And it was the heyday of their animation resurgence. So it was a great place to be.
Would it help a young screenwriter to be living in L.A., or can they work anywhere?
It does help, because that's where you meet film executives, that's where you meet agents, managers, producers, and more importantly, other writers, so that you have a community. You have someone to talk to, someone. A lot of screenwriters, start out in writing groups, and they find a group that they like. They read the material. Someone gets a job. Then they recommend their friend, and their friend happens to be in the writers group. When I first went to L.A., I joined a writers group, and all of us within 2 or 3 years were working almost too much to be in the writers group anymore. We were all in television and film and making a living doing that. And I have another friend who I worked with on Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, George Lucas's show, and when he couldn't do a job because of whatever he was doing at the time, he would recommend me or somebody else. And so you build a community, which is easier to do in L.A. So I would kind of go out there for a while, but if you get established, you can go anywhere because of the technology and internet and stuff. You can do a lot of work on Skype. I've done scripts for people that I've never met, and we do it via Skype. You can do it. I would say go to LA if you can for a while, just because you'll build a community.
You're also lecturing about genre screenwriting. What is that exactly?
I just finished my PhD, and my
congrats.
And my dissertation was on film genre, for screenwriters. Basically, how do you use film genre in the constructive aspects of the screen idea and in the writing itself? And I've come to believe that, along with character arcs, story structure, that film genre is such a great tool for screenwriters. So I approach it in really looking at the classic components of each genre. For instance, the Western is built around a theme of justice, which is a nice way to say revenge, of the need for justice, personal freedom, survival. The horror genre is really, really reliant on evil, bringing the belief to the fore that evil does exist in this world and we must fight it or address it at some point. Science fiction is based on a scientific fact or hypothesis. So you can break down each of these genres into components that can be very active and help you in your writing process. So I'm very passionate about that right now.
Talk about hybridized screenplays. Am I pronouncing that the right way?
Yeah. Okay. So as with most screenplays, and maybe you can say it for most novels, but in screenplays, it's very rare that a film will be in one genre. So you might have a horror romance, or romance is a line that's a genre line that's in many, many films, whether it's the main genre or supporting genre, action adventure, romance, crime thriller, romance. So, and that's very helpful for the screenwriter too, because then now you have more things that you can go, well, have I fulfilled the genre components? And I have all these genres, so that you can go through your screenplay in the polishing stage or even in the ideation stage and go, well, wait a minute, an audience member is coming to my film that's going to be marketed as a romance because they want to believe in love, or they want to see someone struggling to believe in love or something like that. So have I given that to them? Have I gone through all the steps of romance in order to bring the story to the fore? So film genre is really thinking about your audience, knowing why they're coming to your movie, and then giving them what they want, and then in using different hybrids, you can help make it very original, because you might put different genres together than somebody else has.
Mm. Well, since you just finished your PhD, what's next for you?
I'm doing a book on genre. I've just finished a Western script that that I really like. And what else am I doing? I'm the head of the screenwriting master's program at Cal State Fullerton, so right now I'm thinking about what we're going to be doing in the fall. I don't know. The PhD was absolutely the best thing that I've done. It was just, it made my writing better. It made my thought process better. It made me excited about writing. So I probably will just go back to writing, you know, screenplays. And it's going to be a fun year.
This is great information for all the aspiring screenwriters out there. Thanks so much for stopping by.
The wicked riff of Barracuda, the raw energy of Crazy on You. These songs and more are part of the fabric of American music. Heart, fronted by Ann and Nancy Wilson, has given fans classic raw rock and roll for more than three decades. As the only sisters in rock who write their own music and play their own instruments, Ann and Nancy have always stood apart. By refusing to let themselves and their music be defined by gender, the Wilson sisters have made their mark and, in the process, paved the way for many of today's female artists. In Kicking and Dreaming, a story of heart, soul, and rock and roll, Ann and Nancy, with the help of critically acclaimed music biographer Charles Cross, recount a journey that has taken them from a gypsy-like life as the children of a globe-trotting Marine to the backroads of Vancouver, where they got their start as a band, to the pinnacle of success, and sometimes excess. In these pages, readers will learn the truth about the relationship that inspired Magic Man and Crazy on You, the turmoil of interband romances gone awry, the reality of life on the road as single women, and then as mothers of small children. And you'll hear the thrill of performing and, in some cases, partying with the likes of the Rolling Stones, Stevie Nicks, Van Halen, Def Leppard, and other rock legends. Through it all, the sisters draw their strength from a family bond that trumps all else.
In the four decades that Ann and I have been in music, we've been asked countless times what it's like to be a woman in rock. This question is asked in virtually every interview we do, by men and by women. We sit politely and try to come up with an answer we hope will encourage others. But what I really want to do is scream questions in reply, like, what's it like to be a human being in rock? What's it like to be a human being on the planet? In 40 years, we've never come up with the perfect answer to the women in rock question or the other common question, why did you first think women could rock? We have no perfect answer for the simple reason that we never thought gender was a barrier to picking up guitars. We started playing because we loved music. If we would have known how difficult it would be to be women fronting a band, it might have stopped us, but probably we would have done it anyway. Yet there is a secret chapter in our family history that might explain our urge to fight against the norm, so to speak. The story itself is in American history textbooks, but our connection to it has never been revealed. It has long been part of our family lore, passed down to us. I've since passed the story on to my children, as has Anne, and my older sister Lynn. It is a story of murder, kidnapping, and revenge with enough gruesome details to make any behind-the-music episode look tame. So imagine an alternative world where Anne and I are sitting down with an interviewer who asks, "Why did you think you could be a woman in rock?" Our answer, "Because we are descended from a notorious woman who murdered men with a hatchet, scalped them, and later sold their scalps for a reward." My bad joke inside the Heart tour bus has long been that I am not the first family member to slay people with an axe. The original axe slayer was Hannah Dustin, our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. Dustin was our mother's maiden name. I first heard Hannah's tale from my mother when I was 5. Before I picked up a guitar, I must have heard the story 100 times. Family gatherings were always important to the Dustins, and the tale would have slightly different shading whether an aunt or uncle or my mom was telling it. The basic framework was always the same, though, and always horrific and shocking. In some strange way, because Hannah's actions were so unexpected and so rare for a woman, I always felt secretly proud of murderous Hannah. Her infamy began in March 1697 in Haverhill, Massachusetts, not far from Salem. During King William's War, French emissaries bribed the Abenaki tribe to attack an English settlement. 27 colonists were killed and 13 taken hostage. Hannah's husband escaped with 8 of their children, but she and her newborn daughter Martha were kidnapped. The hostages were marched toward Quebec. On the way, the Indians killed 6-day-old Martha by smashing her head against a tree. Hannah had to watch as her newborn was murdered in front of her. 6 weeks later, Hannah was still being held hostage on an island in the Merrimack River. One night, while her captors slept, she loosened the rope used to tie her wrists, grabbed a tomahawk, and killed one of the men who was watching guard over her. Seeing Hannah's actions, another hostage killed the other guard. Hannah then used her bloody hatchet to kill 2 Indian women and 6 of their children. Hannah and the hostages climbed into canoes and began to head down the river away from the carnage. But before they went far, Hannah had second thoughts. There was more venom in her. She went back to the island to scalp her victims. Holding the gory scalps, she climbed back into the canoe and escaped. It took her several days to reach Haverhill and her family. Here's where the tale always really amazed me as a child. Once Hannah was back in civilization, she turned the scalps in for a reward. The Massachusetts General Court awarded her the princely sum of £25 for the scalps. They paid her for her bloody act of murderous revenge. I'm not making this up.
We've just heard Kicking and Dreaming by Anne and Nancy Wilson. Readers, Pete Townsend's autobiography, Who I Am, has just been released. So, who among us are fans? Me! In college, I saw The Who perform live at least 6 times, saw their movie Tommy about 10 times. I even saw Pete and Roger Daltrey perform live just a few years ago. And yes, Roger Daltrey still looks that good. So, Pete's book, which he performs, unlocks band secrets you never knew, like the good Mr. Townsend wanted to be a sculptor, a journalist, a dancer, and a graphic designer. Instead, he became a musician, composer, librettist, fiction writer, literary editor, and sailor. Pete smashed his first guitar on stage in 1964 by accident and stole his windmill guitar playing from Keith Richards. With his incredible musicality, he invented the Marshall Stack, Feedback, and the concept album. And Pete writes honestly about his life, of how he followed Keith Moon off a hotel balcony into a pool and nearly died, did too much cocaine and nearly died, drank too much and nearly died. It's an intriguing story of the man, the band, and the times. So, rockers, time to get on this magical memoir bus and enjoy the ride.
We're playing R&B. Smokestack Lightning, I'm a Man, Roadrunner, and other heavy classics. I scrape the howling Rickenbacker guitar up and down my microphone stand, then flip the special switch I recently fitted so the guitar sputters and sprays the front row with bullets of sound. I violently thrust my guitar into the air and feel a terrible shudder as the sound goes from a roar to a rattling growl. I look up to see my guitar's broken head as I pull it away from the hole I've punched in the low ceiling. It's at this moment that I make a split-second decision, and in a mad frenzy I thrust the damaged guitar up into the ceiling over and over again. What had been a clean break becomes a splintered mess. I hold the guitar up to the crowd triumphantly. I haven't smashed it. I've sculpted it for them. I throw the shattered guitar carelessly to the ground, pick up my brand new Rickenbacker 12-string, and continue the show. That Tuesday night, I stumbled upon something more powerful than words, far more emotive than my white boy attempts to play the blues. And in response, I received the full-throated salute of the crowd. A week or so later at the same venue, I ran out of guitars and toppled the stack of Marshall amplifiers. Not one to be upstaged, our drummer Keith Moon joined in by kicking over his drum kit. Roger started to scrape his microphone on Keith's cracked cymbals. Some people viewed the destruction as a gimmick, but I knew the world was changing and a message was being conveyed. The old conventional way of making music would never be the same. I had no idea what the first smashing of my guitar would lead to, but I had a good idea where it all came from. As the son of a clarinetist and saxophonist in the Squadronaires, the prototypical British swing band, I'd been nourished by my love for that music, a love I would betray for a new passion, rock and roll, the music that came to destroy it. I am British. I am a Londoner. I was born in West London just as the devastating Second World War came to a close. As a working artist, I've been significantly shaped by these three facts, just as the lives of my grandparents and parents were shaped by the darkness of war. I was brought up in a period when war still cast shadows, though in my life the weather changed so rapidly it was impossible to know what was in store. War had been a real threat or a fact for three generations of my family.
We've just heard Who I Am by Pete Townsend. Readers, this is our only title today not read by the author, but it's so big the book report just had to bring it to you. Author Philip Norman has long towered above other rock biographers with his definitive studies of the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Elton John, Buddy Holly, and John Lennon. Now, Norman turns to a rock icon who is perhaps the most notorious yet enigmatic of them all. Throughout five decades of fronting the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger has been seen as the ultimate arrogant, narcissistic superstar, whose sexual appetite and cavalier treatment of women rivals Casanova's, and whose supposed reckless drug use touched off the most famous scandal in rock history. Now a grandfather nearing 70 and a British Knight of the Realm, he still remains the model for every young rock singer. Norman shows Jagger to be a character far more complex than the cold arch seducer of myth. Human, vulnerable, often impressive, sometimes endearing. Here is the real story of how the Stones' brilliant first manager, Andrew Oldham, transformed a shy economics student named Mick Jagger into a modern antichrist. Of Jagger's vicious show trial and imprisonment on minuscule drug charges in 1967. His unpublicized heroic role at the Altamont Festival that brought the sunny 60s to a horrific end. His cavalcade of beautiful women and the enduring but ever-fraught partnership with his glimmer twin, Keith Richards. Mick Jagger, above all, explores the keen and calculating intelligence that's kept the Stones on top as the world's greatest rock and roll band for nearly half a century. James Langton narrates.
To become what we call a star, it is not enough to possess unique talent in one or another of the performing arts. You also seemingly need a void inside you as fathomlessly dark as starlight is brilliant. Normal, happy, well-rounded people do not, as a rule, turn into stars. It is something which far more commonly befalls those who have suffered some traumatic misery or deprivation in early life. Hence the ferocity of their drive to achieve wealth and status at any cost, and their insatiable need for the public's love and attention. While awarding them a status near to gods, we also paradoxically view them as the most fallible of human beings. tortured by past demons and present insecurities, all too often fated to destroy their talent and then themselves with drink or drugs or both. Since the mid-20th century, when celebrity became global, the shiniest stars, from Charlie Chaplin, Judy Garland, Marilyn Monroe and Edith Piaf, to Elvis Presley, John Lennon, Michael Jackson and Amy Winehouse, have fulfilled some, if not all, of these criteria. How then to account for Mick Jagger, who fulfills none of them? Jagger bucked the trend with his very first breath. We expect stars to be born in unpromising locales that make their later rise seem all the more spectacular. A dirt-poor cabin in Mississippi, a raffish seaport, the dressing room of a seedy vaudeville theatre, a Parisian slum. We do not expect them to be born in thoroughly comfortable but unstimulating circumstances in the English county of Kent. Southern England has always been the wealthiest, most privileged part of the country, but clustered around London is a special little clique of shires known rather snootily as the Home Counties. Kent is the most easterly of these, bounded in the north by the Thames Estuary, in the south by Dover's sacred white cliffs and the English Channel. And rather like its most famous 20th century son, it has multiple personalities. For some, this is the Garden of England, with its rolling green heart, known as the Weald, its apple and cherry orchards and hop fields, and its conical red brick hop-drying kilns or oast houses. For others, it conjures up the glory of Canterbury Cathedral, where turbulent priest Thomas à Becket met his end, or stately homes like Knoll and Sissinghurst, or faded Victorian seaside resorts like Margate and Broadstairs. For others, it suggests county cricket, Charles Dickens's Pickwick Papers, or ultra-respectable Royal Tunbridge Wells, whose residents are so famously addicted to writing to newspapers that the nom de plume, disgusted Tunbridge Wells, has become shorthand for any choleric elderly Briton fulminating against modern morals or manners. Disgusted Tunbridge Wells will play no small part in the story that follows.
That was Mick Jagger by Philip Norman.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains, but it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain, and when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
Unable to commit to his fiancée of nearly 4 years, and with no clear understanding of what was holding him back, actor Andrew McCarthy found himself at a crossroads, plagued by doubts that clung to him for a lifetime. Something in his character always kept him at a distance. So, before he lost everything he cared about, Andrew took to the road. In The Longest Way Home, one man's quest for the courage to settle down, Andrew McCarthy takes readers up the treacherous slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro, aboard a boat on the Amazon, and through dense Costa Rican rainforests. Yes, he covers the miles, but his real journey is one of the spirit. Andrew traces the path from his New Jersey roots, where acting saved his life, to his transformation into a leading travel writer. This is a journey from ambivalence to confidence, from infidelity and recklessness to acceptance and a deeper understanding of the internal conflicts of his life.
We had traveled just 19 miles west. My childhood was left behind. Gone were the backyard wiffle ball games with my brothers that had defined my summer afternoons, as was a small maple tree in the front yard that I nearly succeeded in chopping down with a rubber axe when I was 8. Over were the nights lying in bed talking to my older brother Peter across the room in the dark before sleep came. We had lived atop a small hill, safely in the center of a suburban block in a 3-bedroom colonial with green shutters. Now we would live in a long and low house in a swale on a large corner lot half an hour and a world away. "It looks like a motel," I said when I first saw our new home. Unwittingly, I had spoken to the temporary quality that our lives were about to take on. My eldest brother had just gone off to college, ending the daily battles with my father. No longer would my dad chase Stephen out the window and across the yard in a rage. Peter's star, which had burned so bright, grew suddenly and temporarily tarnished. Driving and girlfriends usurped the passion for sports that had occupied his early years, yet he continued to look after me with a fierce protectiveness. My younger brother Justin, 8 years my junior, was slotted into a new school and tumbled in the wake left by the rest of us. Instead of feeling more confident after our move into a larger home, my parents grew tense. More and more often when the phone rang, I could hear my father's voice echoing from somewhere in the cavernous house. "I'm not here! I'm not here!" Whoever was looking for him, he did not want to be found. At the same time, my mother grew more remote due to an illness that we children knew of only vaguely. It was never discussed with us. In all this space, my family seemed to be coming apart. I was 14. A quiet child, I'd had a rotation of friends and a cycle of movement in my old neighborhood, the loss of which left me untethered. There were woods across the road from our new home, and I began to spend more and more time, alone, picking through the trees and building dams in the stream. Always in the shadow of my brother Peter's athletic ability, my passion for sports waned. I was never a diligent student, and as the work piled up, my interests faded. Noticing my rudderless unease, my mother suggested I try out for the school musical, Oliver. Reluctantly, I went along. When it came to the final audition for the role of the Artful Dodger, I surprised myself with how much I wanted the part. Pitted against another student who, it was made very clear, had a better singing voice and was more desired for the production, I threw myself into my performance in a way that left them no option but to reward me with the role. In describing First Love, the playwright Tennessee Williams once wrote, "It was like you suddenly turned a blinding light on something that had always been half in shadow." I experienced a similarly wondrous sense of discovery with that first role. I felt a power and belonging I had been searching for without knowing I had been searching at all. I knew my experience on stage was a profound one because I told no one of its effect on me. A few years later, when the time came to apply to college, with few options because of my poor grades, I quietly took the train to Hoboken, then the path under the Hudson River, and went to a building off Washington Square in Greenwich Village. On the second floor of a windowless room, I spoke a few paragraphs of a play I had read only a portion of, in front of a petite man with an effete manner who wore a bow tie and a wax mustache.
We've just heard The Longest Way Home by Andrew McCarthy. Long before he starred on some of TV's most beloved and long-running series, such as Taxi and Who's the Boss, Tony Danza was a walking contradiction, an indifferent student who dreamed of being a teacher. Inspiring a classroom of students was a goal he put aside for decades, until one day he gave his dream a shot. What followed was a year spent teaching 10th grade English at Northeast High, Philadelphia's largest high school with 3,600 students. Entering Northeast crowded halls in September 2009, Tony found his way to a classroom filled with 26 students who were determined not to cut him any slack. They cared nothing about Mr. Danza's showbiz creds, and they immediately put him in the hot seat. It was only after experiencing abject terror for several weeks, and even dissolving into tears on several occasions, that Tony began to pick up the tricks of how to get kids to learn.
I'd like to apologize to every teacher I ever had. My year as a rookie teacher at Northeast High reveals just how hard it is to keep today's tech-savvy and often alienated students engaged, how impressively committed most teachers are, and the outside role counseling plays in a teacher's day. Inevitably, Tony's students and his story will steal their way into your heart, offering sometimes laugh-out-loud moments and hard-won wisdom.
Philadelphia teachers receive only $100 each for classroom supplies for the whole year. Obviously, I was way over budget in more ways than one. So this veteran offered a tactic to save my skin. Never smile before Christmas, he warned. Smiling puts you at their mercy. They'll eat you alive. Fortunately, before I can dwell on this memory, the bell rings. Actually, it screams like an air raid siren. But then the strangest thing happens. Outside, the hallways are bedlam. But in my classroom, dead quiet reigns, even after the first student walks in. She's small and neat, wearing jeans, a white T-shirt, and a plastic headband. She bounces a little on the balls of her feet and grins at me, but doesn't make a sound. I have a big mouth, which is how this whole thing got started. In 2007, I was 2 years into my dream job, hosting a live one-hour TV talk show in New York City. It aired from 10 to 11 every weekday morning on the ABC network, right after Live with Regis and Kelly and before The View. I felt like the king of New York. The show not only gave me a window into the true complexity of the greatest city on earth, but also offered a platform for me to do some serious good. One of my favorite segments was our schoolroom makeovers. The producers would enlist charitable corporations to donate much-needed school equipment, and then we'd take a camera crew into an impoverished school and remake, like, the science lab, the gym, the art room, or the reading room. When we learned that the music department in one school had just 6 instruments for 400 kids, we approached Casio and CG Khan and acquired keyboards and brass instruments. We rebuilt and re-equipped the music room, and that school now has a fine jazz orchestra. Given half a chance, I'd have leveraged my show to rebuild all the public schools in New York. Unfortunately, my show was canceled. Now, just about every TV actor has had a show canceled. It's a basic occupational hazard. But this time for me was different. After the show ended, my wife and I separated. We'd been married 20 years. And only the youngest of our 3 kids was still living at home back in Los Angeles. Plus, I could smell 60. 60's over the speed limit. My dad only lived to be 62. Suddenly it hit me that I could be running out of time. And this realization made me begin to consider a serious change of direction. I thought about the reasons I'd been so proud of that talk show. And it occurred to me that when we made over all those schoolrooms, I wasn't only trying to address the problem of underfunded schools, but also reaching for a thread that ran all the way back to my own school days. My original career plan in college was to teach. I actually have a degree in history. After graduation, I got rerouted, first into boxing and then into acting. But it was no accident that my character on Who's the Boss ultimately became a teacher. I was still trying to live out my early vocational dream. But playing a teacher on television could never compare with teaching for real. Maybe now was the time to stop, regroup, and get back to the road not taken. The classroom wasn't yet closed to me. I could still make a contribution. Sure I could. Do something that would make my own kids truly proud of me.
That was I'd Like to Apologize to Every Teacher I Ever Had by Tony Danza. Rita Hayworth dancing by candlelight in a small Mexican village. Elizabeth Taylor devouring homemade pasta. Streaking for Sir Laurence Olivier in a drafty English castle. Terrifying a dozing Jackie O. Carrying an unconscious Montgomery Clift to safety on a dark New York City street. Captured forever in dropped names, famous men and women as I knew them, Frank Langella's encounters with movie stars, presidents, royalty, literary lions, and the social elite are profoundly affecting, funny, wicked, sometimes shocking, and always irresistible. What, for instance, was Jack Kennedy doing on that coffee table? Why did the Queen Mother need Frank's help?
how did Brooke Astor lose her virginity? And was that Robert Mitchum singing Gilbert and Sullivan patter songs? Drop Names is, like its subjects, riveting and unforgettable.
Remember when everything meant so much? When you felt whatever it was you were feeling had never been felt by anyone else? Remember the yearning? She was my first. Not bad for a boy of 15, awaking one Saturday morning preparing for his inauguration. It had taken a while for me to save enough from my allowance and the birthday dollars from my uncle's, which I rolled tightly in a rubber band and hid behind the radiator in my room, but I was determined. When I had the necessary amount, I adjusted my wings, bolted from my small house in Bayonne, New Jersey, for Journal Square in Newark, and flew, so to speak, on a bus to the Port Authority Terminal in New York City for the first time. It was the winter of 1953. Dwight D. Eisenhower had just delivered his first inaugural address. Our borders were safe and we were at peace, but I hardly noticed. Inside my head, there were larger issues at stake. I thought then that New York City meant only Times Square. Somehow I believed that if I went too far north, south, east, or west, I would fall into the ocean or hit a mountain. So I wandered the streets from 42nd to 50th between 7th and 8th Avenues, unaware of what lay beyond, and equally unaware of what I was looking for. I didn't have much time. If lightning was going to strike, it would have to be by sundown, when I would need to be back home before being missed. Late in the afternoon, as it was growing dark, I was racing back to the Port Authority, disappointed, my head down against the icy wind. Coming slowly toward me on a side street was a long black limousine. When it stopped, the driver jumped out, came around to open the curbside back door, and as he did, he put his other hand out, palm up, to block my way, just so the passenger's path would be clear and undisturbed. From inside the darkness, a white-gloved hand reached out for help, and it was given. Then came a face of dizzying beauty, the head slightly lowered to avoid disrupting the spun-gold blonde hair, caressing a white fox collar clutched close to a milky white throat. As she emerged fully, a long white coat emerging with her like hot steam freeing itself from inside an open shower door, my heart began to pound. Once fully standing on the street, she let go of the collar, allowing the coat to fall free, and exposing a body encased in a full-length skin-tight gown made of what looked like tiny white pearls, seemingly flung at her in wild abandon and clinging to every pore. Around her neck, over her wrists, and on her ears were brightly sparkling diamonds. She lifted one of her gloved hands, felt for the necklace, and with the other reached for the side of her coat, pushing it back to reveal still more of her. And my pulse raced faster. She turned briefly to her right, saw me standing there, smiled like a sunbeam, and said in a soft whisper, "Hi." Then she glided up some steps into a building and flashes of light obliterated her from my sight. I returned to the Port Authority and sat trembling on my bus as it transported me back home. An indefinable yearning to free myself from a life I instinctively felt was killing my soul had caused me to venture forth that day without guidance or direction, not so much from bravery as from desperation. I was a small, skinny kid in horn-rimmed glasses, born into a middle-class Italian family, feeling always as if I didn't belong there, as if I were in a prison, incarcerated for crimes unknown to me.
That was Dropped Names by Frank Langella. Wow, thanks for the memory. Celebrity autobiographies are always intriguing and reel you in with a delightful anticipation of who will tell what and about whom. I hope you felt this group makes for compelling reading. If memoirs are not your top genre, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for a world of choices.
Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.